face the people of God. One is that on the one hand, people tend to take upon themselves a work, or even the believers even tend to put a work upon something which God has never given them. And the other is, of course, that people who are given a work by God are reluctant to take on that work. And all the problems which have ever come upon the Church of God has been over this question of position. Now, John the Baptist, of course, was called of God, and therefore his position was God-given, but there was danger that he would accept Satan's splendid bribe, to use Sister White's words, to lay hold upon a position God had never given to him. Now, John the Baptist didn't even give it a second thought. He maintained his integrity and didn't take that place at all. So I turn to Desire of Ages 178 to pick up some points in regard to this question. And I do want to sound in this particular study a very, very solemn warning against believers encouraging a person who shows some promise to adopt a position. Let's not do that, because by certain we can place that person in a position of temptation which will prove their utter ruin. And we have a person or two in the movement right now who is facing ruin because of this very thing. Let me read now paragraph 1 on page 178. For a time, the Baptist's influence over the nation had been greater than that of its rulers, priests, or princes. If he had announced himself as the Messiah and raised the revolt against Rome, priests and people would have flocked to his standard. Every consideration that appeals to the ambition of the world's conquerors, Satan has stood ready to urge upon John the Baptist. But with the evidence before him of his power, he has steadfastly refused the splendid bribe. The attention which was fixed upon him, he had directed to another. Now, I was very impressed when I read this particular paragraph earlier with the fact that Satan offered to John the Baptist a splendid bribe. We tend to think of John the Baptist as being so untouchable, which I think he largely was, that this was hardly a temptation to him, and therefore it's quite pointless for Satan to level that kind of temptation at this man of God. But the facts are that as John preached from day to day, doing the work which God had given him to do, the blessing of God on that faithful work put him in a situation where he had the opportunity to take upon himself a work which God had never planned for him to do. It says that if he had announced himself as the Messiah and raised the revolt against Rome, priests and people would have flocked to his standard. Every visible evidence declared that John the Baptist could have headed a mighty army of rebels against the power of Rome, and every evidence suggests they would have been successful, because didn't they have God on their side? The real fact is, of course, that this would have been the greatest possible disaster for John the Baptist personally, and the people who followed him, and for the mission of Jesus Christ. It would really have ruined the work of God and caused insurmountable problems back there. It was critically essential for the work of Jesus Christ that John the Baptist passed to him the torch of truth and the burden of responsibility at this given point of time. And John the Baptist did that with great faithfulness. Now, his disciples were not as spiritually mature as he was, and they became very concerned, very jealous, very disturbed when they saw the tide of popularity turning away from John to the Saviour. I'll read further down page 178. Day by day the crowds about him lessened. When Jesus came from Jerusalem to the region about Jordan, the people flocked to hear him. The number of his disciples increased daily. Many came for baptism, and while Christ himself did not baptize, he sanctioned the administration of the ordinance by his disciples. Thus he set his seal upon the mission of his forerunner. But the disciples of John looked with jealousy upon the growing popularity of Jesus. They stood ready to criticize his work, and it was not long before they found occasion. A question arose between them and the Jews as to whether baptism availed to cleanse the soul from sin. They maintained that the baptism of Jesus differed essentially from that of John. Soon they were in dispute with Christ's disciples in regard to the form of words properly used at baptism, and finally as to the right of the latter to baptize at all. The disciples of John came to him with their grievances, saying, "Rabbi, he who is with you beyond Jordan, to whom you bear witness, behold, the same baptizes, and all men come to him." Through these words, Satan sought more temptation upon John. Though John's mission seemed about to close, it was still possible for him to hinder the work of Christ. If he sympathized with himself and expressed grief or disappointment at being superseded, He would have sown the seeds of dissension, would have encouraged envy and jealousy, and would seriously have impeded the progress of the gospel. There are some very important points in this paragraph I'd like to mention right now. Now, first of all, we might safely say that there are two reasons in every approach made by people to a problem, that is, dishonest people. First of all, there's the real reason, and then there's the reason they give. And everybody who is on a wrong track, a person who is out of tune with the cause of God, every such person will invent a side issue, will look for some defect or fault or something they can make an issue out of to divert the mind from the real issue at hand. Now, with these disciples of John the Baptist, they made a big thing out of the form of baptism. They complained that Christ's disciples were not doing it quite right. But was that the real reason for their disaffection? No, it wasn't. The real reason was their jealousy over the fact that Christ was now enjoying more success than John the Baptist was. That was the real reason. And you'll find that every time in this work, and we do have these folk arise in rebellion from time to time, that every time a person becomes discontented because they're not recognized in the position which they have assigned themselves, it isn't very long before they're advancing complaints and issues which are not the real reason. And the true people of God have to become able to look beyond the facade to the reality behind, as it was, of course, back in the days of John the Baptist and his disciples. Let's go a little further now. John had by nature the faults and weaknesses common to humanity, but the touch of divine love had transformed him. He dwelt in an atmosphere uncontaminated with selfishness and ambition, and far above the miasma of jealousy. He manifested no sympathy with the dissatisfaction of his disciples, but showed how clearly he understood his relation to the Messiah, and how gladly he welcomed the one for whom he had prepared the way. I want now, by way of comparison, to look at another life, this time back in the Old Testament. And this is the life of Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron. And some priceless lessons are afforded us in this woman's experience when she rebelled against the leadership of Moses and Aaron, or Moses rather. I turn to page 382 in the book Patriarchs and Prophets, the chapter entitled From Sinai to Kadesh, and this gives us a very clear and illuminating picture of how this same problem arose in the camp of Israel. I read now from this paragraph. At Hazeroth, the next encampment after leaving Taberah, a still more bitter trial awaited Moses. Aaron and Miriam had occupied a position of high honor and leadership in Israel. Both were endowed with a prophetic gift, and both had been divinely associated with Moses in the deliverance of the Hebrews. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, Micah 6 verse 4, are the words of the Lord by the prophet Micah. Now one would think that a person such as Miriam and Aaron, because both were very much involved in this rebellion, who had been honored so highly as this, note the words again, Aaron and Miriam had occupied a position of high honor and leadership in Israel, both endowed with a prophetic gift, and both had been divinely associated with Moses in the deliverance of the Hebrews. And one would think that persons in such high positions of trust and honor, enjoying privileges such as they enjoyed, would be immune from this kind of temptation. But on the contrary, it seems that this is the very situation where folk are most prone to lose their balance and topple. After all said and done, which angel up in heaven fell? Was it a low-level angel or the brightest and best of them all? We know the answer, don't we? In fact, the position occupied by Lucifer in heaven is a counterpart to a position occupied by Aaron and Miriam in the camp of Israel. Let's read now a little further to see what happened between these folk and Moses. Miriam's force of character had been early displayed when, as a child, she washed beside the Nile the little basket in which was hidden the infant Moses. Her self-control and tact God had made instrumental in preserving the deliverer of his people. So right now, let me emphasize the point that Moses owed Miriam a tremendous debt of gratitude. In fact, he owed her his very life, did he not? Because if she had not, at the on the shores of the Red Sea, or the River Nile, I should rather say, if she'd not displayed the great force of character, resourcefulness, quick thinking, and trust in God, then she certainly would not have saved Moses from a cruel death. But her resourcefulness and strength of character and her guidance by the Spirit of God led her to do just the right thing to save her brother from death. And thus she preserved the life of the deliverer of Israel and made at that point a very wonderful contribution to the future work of God. And we must give full credit to her for that and not forget with appreciation what she did on that occasion. A little further it goes on to say, richly endowed with the gifts of poetry and music, Miriam had led the women of Israel in song and dance on the shore of the Red Sea. So she was a gifted person, a very gifted person, and no doubt a very energetic, hard-working person too. In the affections of the people and the honour of heaven, she stood second only to Moses and Aaron. In the affections of the people, where did she stand? Second only to Moses and Aaron, which means that she was deeply loved by the people of Israel for her character and for her service. But, there's a rather ugly word appearing at this point, but the same evil that first brought discord in heaven sprang up in the heart of this woman of Israel, and she did not fail to find a sympathizer in her dissatisfaction. And this, of course, is tragic. For her to have the spirit of disaffection was bad enough. But when she found a sympathizer in her dissatisfaction, that was, of course, much, much worse. We can't overestimate the necessity of our being very, very wise in answering to the appeal for sympathy on the part of other people. For instance, if I go back to John the Baptist again, this time I'll move on a chapter or two to where he was imprisoned and died. We find that when he was placed in Herod's prison, that he was very, very despondent there, but his disciples were allowed free access to him. And when they came in day by day, they questioned why, if Jesus Christ was the Messiah, he did nothing to affect John's release. How could he permit his faithful herald to be deprived of liberty and perhaps of life? So these men came to Jesus, to John the Baptist, his own disciples, and began to appeal to his sympathies, to his self-interest and so forth. And they tried to get John the Baptist to sympathize with them in their philosophies. And these questions, we're told, were not without effect. Doubts which otherwise would never have arisen were suggested to John. Satan rejoiced to hear the words of these disciples and to see how they bruised the soul of the Lord's messenger. Then Sister White says, "Oh, how often those who think themselves the friends of a good man and are eager to show their fidelity to him prove to be his most dangerous enemies. How often, instead of strengthening his faith, their words depress and dishearten." And I do believe that we should make some very strict rules for our relationship with one another. And when we find a person coming to us with a murmuring, complaining spirit, when that person begins to tell you that they're hard done by, that they have been mistreated and unjustly cared for, and they begin to enlist your sympathy, and that mission of theirs involves their denunciation of other believers in the movement, or even people out there in the world, we should determine to have naught to do with that situation whatsoever, nothing at all. Now, don't mistake the fact you'll make an enemy for sure if you take a firm stand in this direction, kindly but firmly, but you will, even though you make an enemy, you will cut short. At least you will have done your part to have cut short an evil, cankerous thing which will cause the loss of souls in the cause of God. And we need to develop wisdom in this respect. Now, for instance, if Aaron back there said to Miriam, "Now look, Miriam," he should have said to her, "you're quite unhappy about Moses and what God has done through him and what he's done, but be awfully careful and practice the principles of self-effacement, self-abnegation, that's what I'm looking for, the principle of self-abnegation. Take your problem to God and God alone. Don't whisper your complaints around about the place." That would have gone a long way to cutting short Miriam's rebellion and apostasy. But instead of that, he sympathized with her, and that, of course, strengthened her. I've noticed something, that whenever a person in this movement, we've had a long string of these people now from way, way back then to the very present time, that when these people begin their disaffection, what they look for and try and cultivate is human support. They'll talk, they'll write, they'll appeal to your sympathies to get this human support, And it isn't very long before they're saying, none of the believers around here agree with you. They all agree with me, every one of them. And of course, what's happened is that maybe one or two folk do agree, but most folk sort of take the attitude of saying nothing at all. They just listen and say, oh, yes, yes, or no, no, and go their ways. And the person, because they're self-persuading themselves, they think that they've got universal support. And they're kind of startled when eventually the thing comes to a showdown and they find themselves actually very much alone. Charlie Morgan found it that way back in 1975, for instance. Now, what was the trouble back then? I now read from page 383 in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. In the appointment of the 70 elders, Miriam and Aaron had not been consulted, and their jealousy was excited against Moses. At the time of Jethro's visit, while the Israelites were on the way to Sinai, the ready acceptance by Moses of the counsel of his father-in-law had aroused in Aaron and Miriam a fear that his influence with the great leader exceeded theirs. In the organization of the council of elders, they felt that their position and authority had been ignored. Miriam and Aaron had never known the weight of care and responsibility which had rested upon Moses, yet because they had been chosen to aid him, they regarded themselves as sharing equally with him in the burden of leadership, and they regarded the appointment of further assistance as uncalled for. Moses felt the importance of the great work committed to him as no other man had ever felt it. He realized his own weakness, and he made God his counselor. Aaron esteemed himself more highly and trusted less in God. He had failed when entrusted with responsibility, giving evidence of his weakness and of the weakness of his character by his base compliance in the matter of the idolatrous worship at Sinai. But Miriam and Aaron, blinded by jealousy and ambition, lost sight of this. Aaron had been highly honored by God in the appointment of his family to the sacred office of the priesthood, yet even this now added to the desire for self-exaltation, and they cried, "Hath the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not spoken also by us?" Regarding themselves as equally favored by God, they felt that they were entitled to the same position and authority. Now, once again, and I'm thinking of the various rebellions we've seen in this movement right from the start to the present time, invariably, the men or women, as the case may be, who rise up, claim that they too are getting revelations of truth from the Most High. And they claim that unless their particular contribution divinely supplied, so they claim is taken up and taught along with the general message, the movement is facing doom and gloom and so forth. Now, I found myself placed under great pressure by people near to me, very close at times in this respect, but I have always taken those problems back to God, determined I'll preach nothing but that which He Himself gives to me. And I say to these folks, now look, God does not give you a message for me to preach. If God gives you a message, if God wants that priest, He'll give it to you to preach it, and you preach it. I'm not going to do so. The lesson, the light which I receive from God is what I preach, and nothing else but that. And so Moses and Aaron raised this cry, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not spoken also by us?" And the answer is, of course, Moses was God's spokesman back at that point of time. Yielding to the spirit of dissatisfaction, Miriam found cause of complaint in events which God had especially overruled. The marriage of Moses had been displeasing to her, that he should choose a woman of another nation instead of taking a wife from among the Hebrews was an offense to her family and national pride. Zipporah was treated with ill-disguised contempt. Though called a Cushite woman, the wife of Moses was a Midianite and thus a descendant of Abraham. In personal appearance, she differed from the Hebrews in being of somewhat darker complexion. Though not an Israelite, Zipporah was a worshipper of the true God. She was of a timid, retiring disposition, gentle and affectionate, and greatly distressed at the sight of suffering. And it was for this reason Moses, when on the way to Egypt, had consented to her return to Midian. He desired to spare her the pain of witnessing the judgments that were about to fall upon the Egyptians. When Zipporah rejoined her husband in the wilderness, she saw that his burdens were wearing away his strength, and she made known her fears to Jethro, who suggested measures for his relief. Here was the chief reason for Miriam's antipathy to Zipporah. Smarting under the supposed neglect shown to herself and Aaron, she regarded the wife of Moses as the cause, concluding that her influence had prevented him from taking them into his counsels as formerly. Had Aaron stood up firmly for the right, he might have checked the evil. But instead of showing Miriam the sinfulness of her conduct, he sympathized with her, listened to her words of complaint, and thus came to share her jealousy, and of course to greatly inflame the unfortunate feelings that were in the heart of Miriam at this time. Now I love this next sentence very much, where it says, their accusations were borne by Moses in uncomplaining silence. And that way Moses demonstrated the greatness of his character. He did not fight back, he didn't retaliate, but silently went about his God-appointed duties, leaving the problem totally and completely in the hands of God. And God took a hand in the matter in a most decided way. I read further. It was the experience gained during the years of toil and waiting in Midian, the spirit of humility and long-suffering there developed, that prepared Moses to meet with patience the unbelief and murmuring of the people and the pride and envy of those who should have been his most unswerving helpers. They were nearest to him, were they not? His closest relations, and they ought to have been his unswerving helpers, but instead they were rebels. Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth, and this is why he was granted divine wisdom and guidance above all others. Says the scriptures, the meek will he guide in judgment, and the meek will he teach his way. The meek are guided by the Lord because they are teachable, willing to be instructed. They have a sincere desire to know and to do the will of God. The Saviour's promise is, if any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine. And he declares by the Apostle James, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and abateth not, and it shall be given him. But his promise is only to those who are willing to follow the Lord wholly. God does not force the will of any. Hence he cannot lead those who are too proud to be taught, who are bent upon having their own way. Of the double-minded man, he who seeks to follow his own will while refusing to do the will of God, it is written, let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. James 1 verse 7. God had chosen Moses and put his spirit upon him, and Miriam and Aaron by their murmurings were guilty of disloyalty not only to their appointed leader but to God himself, which makes this rebellion an extremely serious one. The seditious whispers, now here God takes a hand, and we find how abhorrent to God this whole thing was, and how straight God was about the whole business, and how signally he punished allowed punishment to come upon Miriam, and it threatened Aaron as well. The seditious whisperers were summoned to the tabernacle and brought face to face with Moses. And Jehovah came down in the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam. Their claim to the prophetic gift was not denied. God might have spoken to them in visions and dreams, but to Moses, whom the Lord himself declared faithful in all mine house, a nearer communion had been granted. With him God spake mouth to mouth, wherefore then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord was kindled against him, and he departed. The cloud disappeared from the tabernacle in token of God's displeasure, and Miriam was smitten. She became leprous, white as snow. Aaron was spared, but he was severely rebuked in Miriam's punishment. Now their pride humbled to the dust, Aaron confessed their sin and entreated that his sister might not be left to perish by that loathsome and deadly scourge. So if we are needing an evidence of how God regards this kind of seditious whispering, this kind of rebellion, this kind of murmuring and complaining that involves the assassination of another character or characters, as the case may be, discontent because there has not been the recognition of the position the person assigned to themselves, this story certainly tells that. God was so displeased that he so completely withdrew from Miriam that she was smitten with the most loathsome of all diseases, leprosy. Now, fortunately for her, she repented together with Aaron. Well, if anyone didn't repent, of course, in the face of that direct revelation of God's displeasure, then there would be no hope for them at all. In answer to the prayers of Moses, the leprosy was cleansed. Miriam was, however, shut out of the camp for 7 days. Not until she was banished from the encampment did the symbol of God's favor again rest upon the tabernacle. In respect for her high position and in grief at the blow she had fallen upon her, the whole company abode in Hazeroth awaiting her return. Now that certainly must have been 7 very miserable days for her and very solemn days for the rest of the people. This manifestation of the Lord's displeasure was designed to be a warning to all Israel, to check the growing spirit of discontent and insubordination. If Miriam's envy and dissatisfaction had not been signally rebuked, it would have resulted in great evil. Envy is one of the most satanic traits that can exist in the human heart, and it is one of the most baleful in its effects. Says the wise man, wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous, but who is able to stand before envy? It was envy that first caused discord in heaven, and its indulgence has brought untold evil among men. Where envy and ending in strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. It should not be regarded as a light thing to speak evil of others or to make ourselves judges of their motives or actions. He who speaks evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law but a judge. James 4 and verse 11. There is but one judge, he who both will bring to light the hidden things of darkness and will make manifest the counsels of the heart. And whoever takes it upon himself to judge and condemn his fellow men is usurping the prerogative of the Creator. Now I love that sentence very much. Whoever takes it upon himself to judge and condemn his fellow men is usurping the prerogative of the Creator, and that, of course, is the papacy. Let's not do it. Let's not be party to it. Remember when I was over here last year, I received a letter from a person in Australia who took upon himself that position of judging and condemning fellow believers, or we'll call them fellow believers. I don't know whether he was a believer any longer. And we're fellow believers in the movement. And I determined not to be a party to that kind of thing, so I wrote a letter back to this person advising him that I wanted no part of that kind of ministry or work. And I asked him kindly and courteously not to write to me any more letters of that nature. I did make a deadly enemy. He's still my deadly enemy. The next letter I got back from him was a very, very harsh and wicked letter, this time condemning me. But I didn't care about that because I knew I'd done the right thing, and better not to be paid to that sort of thing by any way condoning it. I read the last paragraph now. The Bible especially teaches us to beware of lightly bringing accusations against those whom God has called to act as his ambassadors. And that applies to every one of us, of course. We're all God's ambassadors. The Apostle Peter, describing a class who are abandoned sinners, says, presumptuous are they, self-willed, they're not afraid to speak evil of dignities, whereas angels, which are greater in power and might, bring not railing accusations against them before the Lord, 2 Peter 2:10 and 11. And Paul, in his instruction to those who are placed over the church, says, against an elder receive not an accusation, but before two or three witnesses. He who has placed upon men the heavy responsibility of leaders and teachers of his people will hold the people accountable for the manner in which they treat his servants. We are to honour those whom God has honoured. The judgment visited upon Miriam should be a rebuke to all who yield to jealousy and murmur against those upon whom God lays the burden of his work. Very clear and straight counsel. Now, I would like to suggest a proposition to you today, which I want to suggest to the other camp meetings across the country as well. We haven't had this problem very often. Quite a number of years ago we did. There was a certain individual in Australia who had been in the movement for a number of years, and who was most concerned with taking up a position as a full-time preacher. Back in those days, we were quite inexperienced and naive in this field of gospel order and appointment. And this man was extremely good at teaching from the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy. He had a very good knowledge of both. He could quote texts from memory from all over the place, and Spirit of Prophecy statements too. And he looked like a man of very great promise and certainly desired most earnestly to be a full-time worker. So, way back in 1965, we suggested to him and the group in South Australia, which was about 30 people strong in those days, that he be regarded as a self-supporting worker down in that part of the world. And so the plan was put into action, and we made the plan. Now, while this young man could certainly preach fluently and spoke three languages, German, Dutch and English, and this was important because there were German and Dutch people down there as well as English-speaking people, he did not have his family under control, that was for sure, but we didn't pay much attention to that in those days. And a little while, he had broken that group to pieces, and we had to go down and try and weld it together again, which we didn't even succeed in doing. So then came the Palm Woods and became involved in medical missionary work. And everything he touched seemed after that to go bad. And so I said to him one day, I said, Bevan, I want you to understand from now on I'm not prepared to any longer support any plan for you to be a full-time worker. Whereupon he said to me, all right, he said, if you won't support me, I'll get the job myself. It wasn't long before the opportunity came, and he journeyed, and there was an American visiting in Australia, and this man asked him to come to the United States of America and preach the message over here. And he joined up with about six other people, two up here in Canada, one on the east and one on the west, and some folk in California, and one, I think, a little bit further east. Now, he came across to this country pretending, I suppose, to be a member of this movement. So at the time, I wrote a letter to the believers who were in California in particular, and I think also up here in Canada, the ones who were here at that time, and advised them that this man was coming to America. I had nothing to say against him at all, excepting that he did not come with the approval of the church in Australia. In this way, I felt that I had a duty to perform to warn the group in America that this man was coming, that he would no doubt claim their hospitality and claim their friendship, but he did not come with the approval of the church in Australia. And when he came across here, the believers gave him a hearing, I do believe, but he soon discredited himself and came back to Australia a complete and utter failure. And today is back in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, doing I don't know for sure quite what. Now, I believe that when a person is, shall we say, in your group here in Canada, or in our group down in Australia, or a group down in California, and that person quarrels with the believers down there, especially if that person is seeking position for himself and doesn't get that position, and undertakes a work of condemnation and accusation, and can no longer fellowship with the believers, and especially if that person now begins to argue in favor of return to the church again, and then that person comes into possession of money and decides to travel overseas, supposing a Canadian goes to Australia for a visit, then it would be the obligation of you people to write us a letter and warn us that this man is coming and that he has a big problem to settle with the church here. And our duty would then be to say to that man when he comes to Australia, we will not entertain you, we will not even listen to you until you go back to your own home country and be at peace with your brethren there. Because if he hasn't made peace with his brethren here, what will he do down there? He'll extend unrest down there as well. He'll only extend the problem. And I've seen this happen before. There was a family once who came to Australia from over in Tennessee, and I learned too late that this family had a long record of unpeaceful associations and disturbing associations wherever he went in his family. He'd go to a certain area, he'd fellowship with the church there, and very soon he would have fallen out with them. So he would pack up his bags and go somewhere else, and he would take the same unrest wherever he went. And I don't believe that when a person falls out with the local group in any part of the world and leaves them in a divided state so far as he's concerned, and especially if that person now becomes dedicated to disturbing the work of God wherever he possibly can, that person should not even be entertained by us. We shouldn't even extend him hospitality. We simply say to him, you come here for an evil purpose, and we don't plan to give you a foothold in this country at all, under any circumstances. And if we would do this, we'd protect each other, of course, from unnecessary suffering. So this is something well worth thinking about in this respect. And at the moment, I just should mention the person in Australia who plans to travel the world he's going to South Africa in September, and then he's coming to America and possibly Canada next spring. His name is Wally Fuchs. He is a cripple. He's broken friendship with every person in the group down in Australia because of his behavior. He is dedicated to warring against the movement. He's now arguing for return to the church. And his special mission is to discredit the message and the messenger as much as he possibly can. Now, I'm not the least bit concerned about what he may say about me personally, even though it's rather ugly. What I am concerned about is preserving you people from suffering what we've had to suffer. If you want to entertain, that's your business. But I'm warning you right now that if he does come to this part of the world, you can know that he's the person to whom you should simply say, we have no time to listen to you and will not listen to you until you make peace with your brethren down in Australia. Otherwise, he's only extending his unrest into this country as well. So then, let me come back in the last few minutes to the main point I'm making, that is this, that Miriam, especially, and Aaron too, tried to put themselves into a position where God had never placed them. They tried to exalt themselves exactly as Satan did up in heaven, and when they could not get the position they thought belonged to them, it all began back when Moses and his wife, or Moses was joined by his wife, and that is Zipporah, and she lovingly made some suggestions which were carried out to ease the burden on Moses, And then Miriam felt that her position was threatened, and instead of having the same self-abnegatory spirit that marked the life of John the Baptist, she began to make moves to get to protect herself in that position. And when she found herself not achieving the recognition that she thought she ought to have, then she began to attack the position of Moses quite vigorously. And as I said, during the whole thing, Moses bore their accusations were borne by Moses in uncomplaining silence. And thereby he showed true greatness, true dependence upon God, and true Sabbath rest in taking the stand at that point of time. He did it, I suppose, to a certain extent because he understood the principles involved, but more particularly he did it because of the spirit which was in him. As Sister White says, the spirit of humility and long-suffering there developed. That prepared Moses to meet with patience and unbelief, the unbelief and murmuring of the people, and the pride and envy of those who should have been his unswerving helpers. Now, John the Baptist, I'm very thankful to say, had a very different spirit indeed. I don't have time to go through the entire chapter now. But on page 181, or perhaps I should go back to page 180 in Desire of Ages, the soul of the prophet, emptied of self, was filled with the light of the divine. As he witnessed to the Saviour's glory, his words were almost a counterpart of those that Christ himself had spoken in his interview with Nicodemus. John said, "He who comes from above is above all. He that is of the earth is earthly and speaketh of the earth. He that cometh from heaven is above all. For he whom God hath sent speaketh the words of God, for God giveth not the Spirit by measure unto him." Christ could say, "I seek not mine own will, but the will of him of the Father who hath sent me." To him it is declared, "Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed you with the oil of gladness above your fellows." The Father giveth not the Spirit by measure unto him. So with the followers of Christ, we can receive of heaven's light only as we are willing to be emptied of self. We cannot discern the character of God or accept Christ by faith unless we consent to the bringing into captivity of every thought to the obedience of Christ. To all who do this, the Holy Spirit is given without measure. In Christ dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and in him you are made full. Now, what we may say, John the Baptist was not unjustly treated. It was all according to the program, namely that he should be the forerunner and Christ should follow after him. So therefore John was not unjustly treated. Neither was Miriam, but Miriam thought she was. But supposing a Christian is unjustly treated, supposing a Christian is deprived of his rights and so forth, then is he justified in rising up to fight for those rights and to re-establish himself in his position? Not at all. So no matter what the position may be, no matter what the justification of the cause, if you find the person attacking another person's character, complaining about being deprived of the position, complaining about not being recognized, that person is in the wrong, always. And if you support that person, you're in the wrong with that person. And I believe that we can know very quickly where a person stands, because at any time you hear a person complaining about being deprived of position, being deprived of their rights and not being recognized, and that person is mounting a campaign to enlist your sympathies, know that that person is in the wrong every single time, and take a firm stand not to be party to that same wrong. When Korah, Dathan, and Abiram mounted their rebellion for the same reason, and they enlisted the help of 250 princes and their men, then the 250 princes died with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And anybody who becomes supportive of a person who is complaining about loss of position or prestige or lack of recognition, no matter how unjustly they may be treated, no matter how much they may feel justified in doing that, those people are in the wrong. And if we sympathize with them, we endanger our own souls as well. So I do trust that these few thoughts today will help us to realize that there is, we have to be extremely careful in supporting a person who makes claims for themselves, and also be extremely careful not to urge a person into a position. Let God place these people in their positions. Let's not be involved in any kind of work of that nature. Because if we do, of course, we're causing great trouble for them and for ourselves. Jesus Christ, for instance, after the feeding of the 5,000, was in a position where the multitudes were determined to make him king against his will. They had a position mapped out for him. They thought he was qualified for it, which he was, I suppose. But Christ would not let them put him in that position, and thus he saved the great plan of salvation. A few years later, Paul was urged by the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem to occupy a position God had never given him, and look at the awful cost to him and to the Church of God. So I trust we will understand these principles and live by them so as to save ourselves and the Church of God great sorrow and distress. Time is gone, so I'll stop at that point. Any questions you'd like to ask?